Can we start with a quite a recent trip to New York? Because from the outside, listing in US seems like a huge milestone. And just to see the video, you know, of you guys ringing the bell must be a great team feeling. Can you just tell a bit about that trip? How does it feel to list in US, and also maybe the backdrop to listing the company in US?
Yeah, well, I expected less, to be honest. It was quite impressive being in there. And it was an experience that I think we'll remember. And it was very nice to have. And it was also, it was a nice opportunity to be with, you know, three or four people from, we didn't work for OET, but were critical in it getting listed and raising the equity in the first round. And also three of our board members who've been with the company, you know, since July 2018, so it's nice to get that group back together. It was also nice that we have a lot of investor meetings as well in New York, and you know, people are positive about the market, which is great. But even nicer is the investors we have invested with us were all happy, and it's quite easy to have meetings when you know the investors are happy and they feel like everything's been going well. So it was a very nice week in the States doing that. And the reason of listing in New York, I mean, there are multiple reasons. There's a tax efficiency for US investors on dividends, so that they have lower tax if you're listed in the United States versus Oslo. And that's something that we wanted to offer to some of our US shareholders. And then the other thing is that given that we believe built a pretty strong track record in Norway with Norwegian investors and US or international investors who can invest in Norway, we thought it would be a prudent step to establish that track record in the United States with more retail and US-focused only investors. Whether it's, you know, to create more liquidity in OET and have better pricing, or in the future for a potential project even outside of OET and, you know, another listing that we do. So it's about, you know, growing the trust we have with the investors and hopefully increasing liquidity in the share and giving us optionality.
I saw some stats that the liquidity has been quite impressive from the early onset, given you have now, you know, entered the US market with a listing. Are there any trade-offs at all with listing, a dual listing, or only plus-plus if you can handle the resources and all the documentation I can just imagine is required?
It's actually a lot of work. I mean, it at least came in January of last year, and for the next 12 months, his only focus almost was getting the listing through. So it took him and the team a lot of work, and you know, they did a great job getting it done so quickly. It's resources, but there's no downsides to having both. I think we were lucky in terms of the liquidity that, you know, Q2 and Q3 of last year were both strong quarters, and as Q3 was finishing and Q4 was beginning, it seemed that the market was quite a bit weaker and that the shares were overvalued across the tanker space. So you saw a sell-off. I think as December came in and we did the dual listing, the market picked up and improved. The Q1 looked more positive, and there was just a general interest to get back into the shares. And, you know, all the tanker shares rallied from that point onward. So I think we were lucky in the sense that there was an opportunity where people had interest to buy shares, and the U.S., a percentage of our liquidity grew pretty quickly. So again, some of the case studies that we've looked at, the percentage of U.S. trading is quite high compared to others. And we hope to keep improving that as well.
There's a local debate in Norway that, you know, Norway is losing its way as an attractive platform for, you know, broader investments. I don't know if it's a currency thing or many other, you know, internal local policies, but you can see Norway from the outside. Do you see any shifts in momentum building interesting platforms in Norway, or do you feel Norway still is a good place to be many years ahead? Or is that like a very difficult question to answer?
Well, no, I mean, I think that I'm not qualified like Soman Power, some of the other people who've made comments about this, but from my much more limited perspective, I feel like Norway is an excellent first, you know, big step to do. So the investor community in Norway is similar to the Greek, you know, like, although you guys are more advanced, that we act countercyclically, we can invest when it seems that the, you know, there's no light at the end of the tunnel, that there's no cash flow to support the investment. And I think that's like a critical first step for launching new businesses. And the fact that in Norway, you know, we listed OET in 3 or 4 months from the date we had the idea, and I called the S&P broker at Fearnleys to put me in contact with a banker. You can't do that in the United States. And there's a depth in the community that you can raise money for these deals. So I think that Norway should remain a really important first step for launching new shipping or marine-related public equity.
That's good to hear. So from the my personal experience, I was lucky enough to have your father on the podcast a couple of years ago. And then I have to admit, when I did the research about, you know, the whole legacy you have built for, you know, many, many years, I was also super impressed when I started to read about, you know, your grandfather and his journey. And I just thought to myself, you know, faced with adversity, going from one business to another business, going to a new country, setting up a shipping shop like he did in London. It's so impressive. And it's very hard to ask you one simple question, but do you have any reflections you can share for people who just want to understand a bit more about the legacy you have built? Because when people buy into your stock, your family history is also a very substantial piece of that story, because you're the main sponsor behind this company we're talking about today.
I think something that my father and my grandfather passed down is that, you know, having trust and offering a reliable service, whether it's to charters or to investors, is like, it's one of the key elements in being successful over a long period of time. So whether it's how we operate commercially or internally or with our investors, you know, I think that having the trust of the people against us and working hard, obviously, and being reliable in what you say and what you deliver are the key elements. And I appreciate that being handed down to me. I think another thing, especially this was my grandfather's view, and it came all the way down to us, is that, you know, building your own ship and acting countercyclically and being patient pays off in the long run.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about that as well, because one thing is to, you know, have a good business idea and build one company and maybe sell it. Another thing is to become an industrial player, taking big bets and surviving hard times, because maybe that's a bit fascinating with shipping, is that since markets are so cyclical, you also have to have a very strong psychology to ride those waves. Have you seen that your entire upbringing as well? Those discussions and bets always been put on the table?
Yeah, I mean, look, as a child, you know, challenges, hardships, opportunities, you experience them differently when you are sitting at a table and, you know, people are talking about it. But in my professional career, yeah, of course. And, you know, I think that having the comfort that the initial idea, you still defend it and you still believe in it, it's very key to have a conviction. And then entering the cycles correctly historically has shown that you'll be able to weather the storm, you know. So you can't be over-levered. Your ships need to be cheap. But we saw that in 2021 and the end of 2020. You know, those were tough years. Even 2019, you know, originally we had tried to raise 150 million. In the first raise, we did 100. We ended up raising less equity than we had initially budgeted for. So we all had to find ways of doing things cheaper, doing things more efficiently. And at the end, I mean, it was to the benefit of shareholders that we didn't, you know, issue more shares. But there were challenges for sure. And you get used to the anxiety and stress from these challenges after a while.
I can imagine. So what is the framework you use when you're deciding to start Okeanos Eco Tankers? Because what are the stars that needs to be in line in order to make it worthy starting a new company? Is it the order book, mega trends, or is it just a lot of data set that needs to align at the same time? What is the framework you use?
I mean, we're not so sophisticated that there's a formula, you know, that all of a sudden it went green and we said, because this is the one listed company we have, but we had seen this IMO 2020 story coming, and traditionally the company is owned Aframaxes and Suezmaxes. So we wanted to somehow take advantage of, you know, this discrepancy between cheaper fuels, more expensive fuels, and the efficiencies of ships that have these new engines, electric engines then. So eco and scrubber versus non-eco scrubber. And initially, we placed an order for Aframax on the private side with no intention of listing them. But I mean, thankfully, the yard went bankrupt. So these were ice class LR2s at 42 or 43 million. You know, they were extremely cheap ship. The yard went bankrupt. They returned our equity that we had paid so far to us. And over that time, we hit, you know, we had time to study more. We saw obviously that the effect of the scrubber and echo, it magnifies the bigger ship you go to. So we looked at the order book and we looked at pricing on VLCC. We had never owned and operated VLCCs ourselves before. We had them on bareboat. And we saw that, that this opportunity is even greater on VLCCs. But we wanted a partner to go in. And we looked at the public market. And that's how it occurred.
Got it. Last year, I was attending a shipping conference in Greece, and the question was, what segments are interesting to invest in today? And the only thing they can come up with was Greek real estate, because all the segments looked a bit difficult for several reasons. Do you share that same view today as an investor or company builder, that you really need to know what you're doing if you're trying to build a new company in any segments, whether that's LNG, dry bulk, or tankers? Or do you see special opportunities still, given your knowledge and viewpoint?
Yeah, I think the challenge building new businesses today is that you're entering the cycle at relatively high valuations across all sectors. And that's usually, you know, negative. Like, it's a bad check. You know, it could still make sense over time if the cycle is strong enough that it'll move even higher. But to begin a business at these levels is a challenge. You know, like if OET, we have no intention, but if we were to buy a VLCC today in the secondhand market, it would raise, you know, the break even or the average cost per ship, but it wouldn't be the equivalent of our fleet being completely priced at today's level. What would be interesting today? It's tough. I mean, you know, I think that the gas, whether it's LPG or LNG markets, have tough years ahead of them. Obviously, the container as well. The more specialized, I don't know enough about. The dry bulk is interesting. And, you know, there's an order book that's quite limited, and the fleet is aging quite rapidly. Those assets are quite expensive too. I think it's easier if you're a financial investor, because there's a lot more volatility in the share price than there is in the asset price. So you can find opportunities to build a position at more attractive levels, I think, than you can on the physical.
How do you invest yourself? Are you just fully committed to the companies you're involved with, and that takes all the brain energy? Or do you like to look at other companies, maybe trade and see how the trading patterns is and opportunities? Or is it not enough time in your day to be fully focused as also an investor on the side?
I trade quite a bit in the shipping sector and in energy and a little bit of commodities, but shipping is probably 8% of the portfolio. And we have a little team. We're quite active. Shipping is, you know, everything but other than family and sleep. So it's something I enjoy deeply, and it's quite lucrative as well.
Yeah, it seems like an industry where if you truly understand it well, you can have an alpha. I don't know if you agree with that, because it seems like shipping is a bit overlooked for, call it, regular people. Or is that not a fair assessment?
It's a feeling I got in the States when we were in New York, and we're seeing some funds and investors who, they had amounts of capital to deploy that were too large for shipping. So I think it's quite a small industry compared to, you know, some of the other industries in the stock markets or around the world. So it's easier to deploy, you know, smaller amounts of, let's say, private money.
And maybe, I don't know, I think it was Øystein Kalleklev who said that, you know, in US, the funds don't like the dividends, because then they have to reinvest them again. So that's also why, you know, they're not maybe always interested in shipping plays.
That could be too. But I mean, most shipping companies don't give dividends. So they can find quite a few to invest.
I think that's a very fair point. I think you have said that when you raised money for Okeanis Eco Tankers, you know, the Greek reputation wasn't at an all-time high, but you have been a tremendous success story. Have you seen that reputation shift, or is it still, when a Greek company wants to come and raise equity, you sort of, you're not starting an all-time high reputation-wise. So is that constantly a fluid thing, reputation?
You know, I haven't been shown a deal to invest in the Greek-sponsored product. But I can say that it took a long time to develop trust with investors and with the market. Maybe that's not just because you're Greek, but it's an added element to it. But I think that it's not just, you know, it's easy to structure the company in a clean way and answer that some, let's say, trust to the potential investors. But then you also need to prove over time that you're going to execute what you said you would. And, you know, that takes time because the markets can't time them perfectly. So you might have, you know, after COVID, no one expected, obviously, COVID. So we didn't have the opportunity to give consistent dividends or to commercially outperform like we have since then. And it takes good markets and bad markets. It's also important because it's not just one project for us. We really hope that in the future there could be other projects within the marine maritime space. And we would really like to find co-investors again to do similar projects. And hopefully it'll all be easier than the first time.
Definitely, because I also had that question, if this is just like the perfect starting platform in the public markets to build on, or if this is just one-time play. But maybe like you said, you really hope this can be a platform for the future with a public track record, because in a private company, that's a bit of a different ballgame, I guess, than being active in the public.
I mean, just to be clear, so we don't have anyone confused, there won't be like a dry company within OAP or an LNG or whatever. But, you know, outside and separate companies, we would like to consider future products.
So you talk a bit about building trust, and I just looked at some of the slides you had recently with Iraklis, the CFO, and the outperformance is quite impressive. And then the question becomes, how do you manage to outperform peers in a very competitive industry by 20 to 40% commercially? Can you give us a sneak peek into what is the operation behind that? Because it seems like a quite hard industry to outperform in those percentages.
Yeah, I mean, look, one element is being lucky, right? So let's hope we keep being lucky and this continues. But obviously, we have a fleet that no one else has had. I mean, some people have, like Frontline has gotten closer to having a very, very modern fleet recently, but we've been very lucky that our fleet has been extremely efficient. It, you know, completely scrubber built, fitted for the past 4 years, and we've been able to take that delta consistently against our competitors. Another element is, you know, third-party management versus in-house management. We strongly believe that, you know, the commercial and the technical should be done within the same walls. Because, like, you know, and the commercial is incentivized if it does well and you work for the company rather than a pool. You know, I think in every case, a strong, focused owner, private or public, can outperform pools. Because, like, a pool will automatically get ships from owners who are, you know, either too small or they're financial investors and they don't have the interest to maximize because they don't know the business as well. And these ships are all usually, they're less optimal as well. So they may be bought very cheaply or they may be a poor quality or, you know, and a big thing about the ships is what kind of specifications it has. You know, like, is it the right dimensions to call in most ports if it's an Aframax? Is it, if it's a Suezmax, like, does it have 2 20-ton cranes? You know, there's modern ships in publicly listed companies today that don't have 2 20-ton cranes. And what's the problem with that? You can't go to Basel, which Basel is a huge Suezmax terminal. Like, just from that, you're going to lose your performance. So the quality of our ships is really important, both the fact that they're new and efficient and we can burn the cheaper fuel, but also that they're designed to go everywhere and clear all the ports. The fact that we have the in-house commercial management is really important, as well as the operational. And I think another element is that we're the right size where we can kind of be aggressive and nimble. That, you know, the fleet is not too small that we have one ship open in March and then another ship open in May, and there could be a spike in the middle and we miss It's big enough to take the spikes in the volatility, but it's small enough that we can concentrate the fleet in areas that we think may have potential. So, you know, since the war in Ukraine started, we focused all our VLCCs in the West, and we were able to without, you know, having to worry about having three or four or five ships being open at the same time and internally competing. So I would say those three.
That's a great summary. So a very modern, flexible fleet, but also a very hungry and aggressive in-house management who tries to be proactive and be fast on new trends, I guess, because I don't know if it's probably a combination seeing market shifts and also executing quickly, I guess.
I mean, with the chart, with Chris, who does our chartering, you know, we worked together since 2009. He hates losing. So he's extremely competitive. And that's a great trait to have, and it's a great trait to pass on to people in his department as well. But yeah, you know, it's another thing that before I had a family and Chris, we lived shipping day and night. You know, even when we went home, we were talking about how to trade the Aframax and how to optimize performance and stuff like that. So it's a lifestyle.
Definitely. Right now, if you look at the let's call it the mainstream news, there's of course a lot of focus on the Red Sea, Suez Canal, Panama Canal, and the wars we have going. But how do you separate signal versus noise and really find the big stories that is important for your company? Because maybe one of the important parts is to understand, you know, the second and third order consequence of the things the news talk about. And there is where maybe the potential lies, whether that's new trade routes, new alliances. How do you map everything? Is it just pattern recognition, or do you have a very diligent process of looking at data and trends, etc.?
I guess a combination of both. We read a lot and we try to take opinions from all of the different industry participants we can speak to. But it comes down, I think there's a lot of experience and understanding over time. And that's why, you know, shipping is, it's an industry where the previous generations are very important to consult on the effects and the after effects of how things happen, because history does repeat itself.
You touched upon leverage, and I think you have said that you're comfortable with taking leverage. Can you just explain the concept of leverage in a shipping company like Okeanis, and also when does a company become over-leveraged, and that can come with a downside? So can you just explain a bit about how you leveraging the company?
We felt that when we were running different models and seeing what our ships earned compared to what older ships earned and ships without scrubbers, we saw that in a decent, you know, oil price environment, like where historically you see ships getting laid up, is where we would be close to break even, a bit below break even, but in levels comfortable that we can sustain, you know, over a decent period of time, because in shipping you'll always have some volatility. So we felt with the efficiency of our ships and the cyclicality entrance that we had, which prices were very low. You know, we did order these VLCCs at $85 million, including the scrubber, and today it's $128 million. We felt confident that we could enter, you know, with 70-75% leverage. And, you know, it's about optimizing returns for the shareholders going forward through the cycle. So just naturally, I mean, we haven't paid down any debt beyond its natural, you know, amortization. But we've come down to below 50% because of how assets have appreciated. So I think that leverage is really key to being able to optimize the performance for the shareholders. And it's just being able to manage it correctly and understanding where is the line, you know, that you shouldn't exceed and being reckless.
You know, there's a lot of talk about innovation, green fuels, etc. I know that you're not very bullish on, you know, green fuels entering the tanker space anytime soon because of the cost of it, etc. But just looking at innovation in general, do you see a lot of exciting projects, whether that's big or small, that you cover, or is tankers a bit unique that it needs to be cost efficient, hence it's very hard to disrupt anything big on the ships and how they operate?
There are tenders for green projects, and they're valuable because it gives you insight into how to run a new subsegment of our industry with a different propulsion fuel. And I think having that knowledge going forwards at some point will be useful and will give you an edge over the competitors who don't. The problem is that these projects have very, very low returns. And with asset prices where they are today, you're committing a lot of capital on a long term for a project that's expensive, low return. And at the end of the project, it'll have quite a high residual value. And you're making an investment on one of potentially few types of fuels, hoping that in 5 years, that's the one that will prevail, or ones that will prevail. So that's been a challenge for us, and that's why we haven't, really looked into any type of dual fuel propulsion systems like methanol or ammonia or gas. We do, on the private side, have two new buildings in Japan that we're looking at two different types of carbon capture technology. We feel that carbon capture is easier to fit within the tanker space. I mean, you do load from somewhere close to the production area, so you should have some place to deposit in. But my worry is that ammonia and methanol and some of the other fuels, they're going to be bid too high by both other segments within the marine space, but also from onshore use. And that it may become, it may not be viable to be using. But again, I think for us, we believe it in our view that it's prudent again to wait until some cheaper time in the cycle where we may have a bit more clarity on what fuel is and, make our riskier investment then rather than today. The residual and the entry price is high.
I agree with you on that take. Have you ever considered, combination carrier models that you take wet one way and dry materials the other way? Because I always found that a bit of an interesting concept. And I know we have, of course, one company that does it, but do you entertain those types of innovation to combine different materials? Is that just very hard in practice to take out in a good way?
No, I think that Clavinus has done an unbelievable with that company because even there are these VLCCs built by VLOC. Built by Nobusu in the previous cycle. I don't know if you know much about him, but he's an interesting character. They were meant to carry iron ore one leg and crude oil the previous. Most of these ships have now been converted just to VLCCs. And some, because we know some owners who own them, they still have some issues clearing them in ports because they were previously VLOCs. But now they've been converted completely to VLCCs. They can't carry ore. They don't have hatch covers. I'm impressed by how Clavinus has managed to have his niche trade and have both charter, both the dry charters and the wet charters accept the ships. So, they have a lot of experience. They're sophisticated. They know the market. But to break into a niche market like that would be very difficult. We haven't looked at that. I've invested in them. And, I think they're a great company, but for the time being, for more standardized types of vessels where they're a bit more liquid in selling and buying as well.
It makes sense. I also think it's a very impressive execution by them. If you look at the market, do you have any specific market trends you follow? Because from the outside, it looks like, for instance, Brazil is a very interesting story with the production going on over there. Do you have any market trends you find fascinating for 2024 and the years ahead that can tell you a bit about where the market is going to go?
All production west of the Suez is something that we follow quite closely and track. And that's, I think that'll be a key driver of the market going forwards. In the shorter term, I think that looking at inventories and comparing them to overlaying them with OPEC plus policy will be a driver for sure. So OPEC, I think if they achieve steady inventory draws and we have inventories where they feel it's at that level where any lower and we start to have supply concerns, we'll see barrels coming back. And I do expect that to happen sometime in early Q3. I think that's a really important driver, especially for the VLCC market. And yeah, I mean, there's many things that we look at, but I think for the VLCCs at least, you know, west of Suez production and OPEC policy, which I think is driven a lot by inventories, are the two key. Well, you can get into more in depth and start reading about like different types of crudes and the arbitrage between different crudes. And I think that's one thing that's been happening a lot with the Red Sea now that like the Iraqi crude that has been coming historically to Europe is become a lot more expensive because of the freight. You have the different refineries in Europe trying to see how they can displace this Iraqi crude with similar crudes from the Atlantic Basin, let's say. So I think, you know, that's just one example, but I think crude arbs is also very interesting, but that's a bit more short term.
No, but that's an excellent point. So a couple of years ago, you took over the CEO position at Okeanis, and that comes also, I guess, with a lot of focus on the cultural aspect of the company and also a lot of emphasis on hiring the right people and in any case also get rid of the wrong people you take into the company. How do you view, you know, creating a high performance culture in the company? Is that very easy, or is it something you always have to think about once you have the CEO position in a company like Okeanis?
It's a difficult question. I think we're lucky because the people who were with the team before all have that passion and commitment to the company that, you know, that we would like to have. And the new people we have hired also have it. So I think Greece is quite special because shipping is in a lot of DNA in Greece. And I think that people understand that you marry shipping. And you marry the company that you work for. And, you know, you take care of the company and the company or the family takes care of you in the long term. So I hope that with the team we have that we can retire together at some point. You know, I think that the time spent together, especially with us, is a lot longer than most average companies or corporations in the West. You know, especially on, let's say, the operational, on the technical management side, outside of OET and others. There's many people in the office now who are managers in departments who have started as cadets on the ships or, you know, and they've progressed to chief engineers or captains. They've come to the office. They've taken then management of the specific department. So, I think if we find the right people and we gel well and we have the right outlook, we hope that it's for a career.
No, that's very interesting. So, in your hiring philosophy, are you always on the lookout for exceptional people, or do you feel like you have a very good base and the people that come inside the company stays in the company, so it's quite stable regardless, or do you always look for brilliant people to get involved with?
No, to be honest, we're quite introverted. So I think like we have a very strong team, and then if we analyze a gap that we have, we'll go out and fill that gap.
Looking at yourself, taking the transition from, you know, running the operational to, you know, being the leader in the company, has that changed anything for you? Or did you always feel that you were having, you know, sort of that responsibility?
But no, I always felt responsible. And, you know, I always had a large role in the listing initially and throughout in the commercial side of the business. So I don't think that much has changed in terms of the responsibility I feel towards the company or the thought process and decision making that we have.
If you look at the year ahead, what are the most important metrics you judge yourself on and the company? I know it's a lot of different factors, of course, but is it ultimately, you know, the share price and how many people are buying into the company, or do you have other metrics that are super important for you to deliver on?
Yeah, well, I think that the more company-based metrics will give you the share price metrics. So I think we have some refinancings that we'd like to do going forward. So I mean, if we can achieve the terms that we've aimed to achieve, that's, you know, that's a great target. If we can continue to outperform our competitors for 2024, that's another important KPI. We have some dry docks this year on our VLCCs, so getting the ships in and out of the dry dock as quickly as possible. And we're making some investments on the ships on some very high quality paints, and having that paint be as efficient as we want to pay off and not having operational issues. And then I think that if all these things go as we hope, the share will trade well. And, you know, we continue to give dividends and return money to shareholders like we promised. So I would say, but I think the metrics we look at least internally, are a bit more operational or, you know, technically driven.
It's maybe like, you know, in sports, if you just take care of the process, the result will come. But if you get too focused on the end result, you forget maybe the process inside that needs to be there to get the result, maybe.
Because, you know, for the first 4 years of the listing, we were just focused on doing our jobs well, and it was a tough market. And then the market got better, and luckily, the process brought results.
Okay, so I have another segment, and it's a bit of quick fire questions with different topics. And if you don't like the topic, we can skip it and jump to the next one, but I'll let you decide. So last year was my first time in Greece ever. I went to Athens twice, and I must say I was super impressed by the people, the country. And I thought to myself, you know, having that location between three continents have so many benefits attached to it. So I just wonder how you see the Greek economy going forward. Do you see a lot of momentum into growing it, or are you a bit bearish, or how do you view the economy overall?
I think the Greek economy is in a good place because we've had a very hard 15 years since the financial crisis. You know, we didn't catch up with the growth that the rest of Europe had. So we do have that effect a bit coming now since the conservative government was elected in 2019. Tourism is doing very well in Greece, and, you know, it continues to do well, and it's a big element in our growth. And I think the renewable energy is doing quite well as well. So, you know, both solar and to an increasing level today, wind power has been a positive for the state, for the country. So, yeah, I'm bullish on Greece. I don't know if I wouldn't say that real estate in Greece is a better investment than shipping, but I think that Greece will, it has a good few years ahead of it. And I'm really glad that we also have a serious government in a time where the world, you know, tends to has chosen populists over practical government.
Yeah, and I don't know if you share the same view, but my impression from meeting, you know, the younger Greek population as well is that they're all very well educated. They speak English perfectly. They have like the perfect setup, it seems, from my perspective, to really make a difference in building the economy and also being a global player.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, like, I think Greece has some inefficiencies of, you know, being a bit bureaucratic that I'm sure the government is working to overcome. And if they can do this, I think it's an excellent place. Like, as I said earlier, I think that Greeks are extremely hardworking, and they're very caring and committed to the companies or people they work for.
So next topic, what if you have to do something outside of shipping and family, either a hobby or a thing you do to relax your mind, what do you tend to do then?
I run. I mean, today, what I have time for is running. And I can think when I run, or I can just do a podcast when I can run, or what I unfortunately have been increasingly doing recently is I run a little bit slower, and I talk to people in the office or brokers or about shipping. But yeah, I think running is what clears my mind and gives me a bit of energy.
Do you have any very contrarian view that few people share with you?
Probably not, but I on the green compulsion, I'm scared that ammonia and methanol are just way too expensive as a fuel, given the demand that they'll have internationally and the lack of supply networks. Last year, we were very bullish, very dry bulk. So that was actually quite successful for the private side. I was still bearish dry bulk this year, and that has been less successful. And quite bearish LNG, but that's been for a year as well.
Okay, that's interesting. So, most overrated and most underrated island.
Overrated any island that has an international airport, just because, you know, it brings in too much easy tourism. And I think that unfortunately, well, the islands that are harder to get to have maintain themselves in a better way and retain that kind of romantic beauty. On most underrated islands, so I mean, overrated, obviously, you know, like Rhodes, these places, for sure, Mykonos, Santorini, like Santorini, my family's from there, but it's a nice view, Like, I would take a picture and leave. Like, there's traffic. They don't have electricity properly. They don't have sewage. It's a problem. Underrated, yeah. That's I should start with that because there's so many and they're really awesome islands. But my favorite is Dinan. My wife would say Lerro. Kithiran. There's so many. I mean, like, I think that our ships cover most of the underrated islands in the Cycladas, because our ships are only named after the Cycladic islands. So if you look at the names of the ships, it's a pretty good direction.
I think if the Norwegians get this tip and, you know, stay away from the touristic places and look at the Okeanis Eco Tankers fleet, maybe the vacation will be better next summer.
Yeah, but like, look, as a family, having three young kids, I also understand how efficient it is to take one flight to where you're going and not having to take a flight and then a taxi and then a ferry. Convenience.
Definitely. So a lot of the listeners love to dive into business books or other types of books. Do you have any books you can recommend the audience that you have read and that made a mark on you?
As a teenager, I used to read over and over again anything Tom Clancy. So I would read like Red Storm Rising or USS Seawolf. I've read those books three, four times. My favorite books that have an impact for me, probably Shogun by Clavell. And I really like The Courage to Act by Ben Bernanke, which was actually recommended to me by one of our board members.
I'll put that in the show notes and let the audience check it out. So I just have one final question, Aristides. I know you're very busy, but again, a lot of the listeners are very ambitious, want to build an inspiring career, and I know just to work in a company like yours would probably be a dream of many of those who are listening right now. Do you have any, you know, reflections, advice, looking at your own journey? Do you see any patterns of the people you are impressed by and the people you see are managing to build interesting careers? Any trademarks, character traits?
The people who've excelled, let's say, in our organization. I mean, also, the family owns TV, television station, media, newspapers. I think it's being able and confident to speak your mind. That's very important. And even if it means going against, the established thought, I think that's a very important trait to have. And it sets you apart from, everyone else. Whether you're right or wrong, and I think then if you're wrong, admitting you're wrong or why you're mistaken, those are two good traits to have. So, confidence to express yourself, but also the ability to understand when you made a mistake.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect ending. Aristides, once again, thank you so much for finally taking the time. I really appreciate it, and good luck with, you know, keep building the company, and it's a very exciting time ahead, so all the best.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
If you like this episode and the content we produce, head over to my YouTube channel. Just type in Christopher Vonheim. See you next time.
All opinions expressed by Christopher Vonheim or his guests on this podcast are only their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Vonheim. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Christopher Vonheim as a specific reason to invest or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.